Good evening. This is KFER, Dr. Stan, here on 89.9 FM on your radio dial, bringing you the story behind the story, the news behind the news, and trying to convince you that there is nothing as powerful as the truth, but tragically often nothing so strange. And this evening we have a special guest for you. We have Mr. William Rusher, who is the publisher of National Review magazine for many, many years. And today he is a fellow at the Claremont Institute, where a number of very prominent conservative thinkers have gone. Congressman William Dannemeyer is there, Bruce Hutchinson is there, and William Rusher is there. And this is a think tank. This is a place where conservative men go to develop ideas on what we can do to make a better and stronger and more moral nation, of men who are dedicated to the concept of the preservation of our individual liberty under God. Well, in just a moment or two, while we're going to have Mr. Rusher in us, with us, let's just see if we have him on the line here.
Give him a little introduction.
Hi, Mr. Rusher.
How do you do, sir?
Fine, thanks. How are you? All right, fine. Well, let's see if we sound is good and everything's balanced here. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
All right, fine. Well, we appreciate very much your coming with us this evening, and we're going to just talk for a few minutes, and then we'll open our lines to our listeners to call in. And remember, our telephone number here is 464-8295. That's 464-8295 here on Radio Liberty. But we were talking a little earlier in the day about your views on the Clinton presidency, or maybe we should say the Clinton and Hillary presidency. Would you like to share with the audience some of your thoughts on what happens, what's going to happen now that we have sort of a one-party control in the legislature? We have a president and both houses of the legislature firmly in Democratic Party control for the first time, I guess, well, since Jimmy Carter was in Washington, D.C. How do you look at things? Where do you think we're headed?
Got a lot of questions there. one of the important things I think to understand is that by uniting the presidency and the Congress in the same party, we have, whatever else we've done, eliminated the gridlock, which did unquestionably exist during the entire time when the country was electing Republican presidents and Democratic Congresses. I never thought that was a very clever idea. I think a lot of people thought that it was their own little contribution to the separation of powers. But I think it was a bad idea. I would much rather have seen a Republican Congress and a Republican president, but I do think that it is a step in the right direction, at least to consolidate the responsibility. And that's what we've now done. We will know at the end of 4 years which party is responsible if the deficit is increased. When we look out the door, if we see any homeless, we'll know it is no longer Ronald Reagan's problem or George Bush's. There have been 4 years of both a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, and they're there because of the policies that they pursued. So I think, in that sense, it's a step in the right direction, although I think, obviously, that the policies that are being unveiled now are a little short of disastrous. Now, Hillary represents, in a way, a brand new situation for us. So White House wives, first ladies, have always, I think, tended to be influential, no question about that, both Republican and Democratic. But in this particular case, we have a first lady trained as a lawyer, practicing as one for a long time, clearly a smart woman with her own set of political opinions, which she doesn't hesitate acting on. And her husband has now appointed her to devise at the to lead a group of, I understand it's 400 people who are now working on this question of a health plan for the whole country, which will see to it that everybody gets some degree at least of health care. Now, this is objectively, if she is able to produce it, fine. But there are a couple of things that you have to notice that may not at first appear here. One is that every president in the past has necessarily used other people to help him to devise policy. When the policy that was devised turned out to be a poor policy or an unworkable policy, or when they couldn't get together on what the policy ought to be, then it was always possible for the president to deflect criticism, to some degree at least, onto that other individual. And his opponents generally let him do it. It's a lot easier to attack a president's appointments and his secretaries of various cabinet offices and so on than it is to attack a president himself. So we saw that Ronald Reagan, when the pressure pounding grew on Attorney General Meese, finally acquiesced in Meese's stepping down, as I recall, as Attorney General about August of 1988, before the a good half year before the end of Reagan's own term. Just letting him go because so much obloquy had been piled on him, so much of pounding Meese had taken on Reagan's behalf. And the same happened to John Sununu halfway through President Bush's term. Sununu, the chief of staff in the White House, got all the criticism and the heavy attack, and in due course resigned, and Bush sailed on. Now, in this case, we have Hillary Clinton, who is unquestionably going to have to get into some deep controversies in this question of the health plan. And it may well be that she will attract an awful lot of fire and criticism. It may be that she will deserve it. But whether she deserves it or not, being who she is and where she is, she'll attract the fire. We can be sure of that, the criticism. Only this time, you see, Clinton is not in a position to let her go. She's the First Lady. She's his wife. She's there every night. He is, in a sense, stuck with this particular tar baby. In turning her, in other words, into a political being, he has combined two things which have, as far as I can remember, never been combined quite so efficiently and so legally before. A policy position, a political position on the one hand, and a personal relationship on the other. I think we may... Not even John Kennedy was in that kind of a situation with Robert, his brother, as Attorney General. He could always let his brother step out. Now, it's true that Clinton, in theory, could let his wife step out as health czar, or whatever she's going to be, if it doesn't work out well. But it would be a terrible black eye for him if he did, precisely because he cannot really distance himself from her.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that... Hillary said, you know, if you elect Bill, you get me, and that's exactly what they
said. Yeah, she said that, and I remember, buy one, get two for the price of one, all that kind of business. I'm not sure that the American people ever realized quite how literally that was going to be the case, that they were getting Hillary as a policy maker instead of as the First Lady.
Well, you know, the thing that bothers me, I'm a physician, and apparently they're going to design a healthcare system with absolutely no input from physicians, no input from the hospital administrators.
Yeah, that puzzled me a little bit. By the way, I'm using a portable phone here. If you can turn up your volume a little bit, it would help me.
All right, now how is that? Is that any better?
Better, thanks.
All right, fine. Let's just hope that that will...
If it doesn't work, I can always go over to the regular phone and use that.
All right, fine. Is that any better?
This is better, yes.
All right, very good. You know, the problem is, it would appear that they're going to come up with some sort of a socialized medical system, and yet, you know, with the massive deficit we already have, they're talking about providing health care for the 37 million uninsured, and they're talking about $30 to $90 million additional...
It's a billion, I hope.
$30 to $90 billion additional expenses. Well, now, where is that money going to come from? I mean, you're certainly not going to get that from sin taxes, from taxing alcohol and taxing cigarettes, because what's going to happen is people are going to start making moonshine, and they're going to start smuggling cigarettes, and you're going to have to fire a...
I think they will simply have to get it where they can. There's really only one big source of money in the United States, anyhow you look at it, and that's the great bulk of the people, the so-called middle class. And we are simply going to have to turn to them. The rich are not numerous enough, or for that matter, rich enough to pay for all this. And the corporations, of course, you can tax them, but then they just pass along the charge to the consumer, so that essentially we all wind up paying anyway.
Well, you know, I just don't understand how the Democrats can't see that the more you tax people, the more they're going to move to avoid taxation. I mean, this is the story of mankind going all the way back to, you know, when Matthew was the tax collector at the time of Jesus. And even before that, people have always avoided taxation by whatever means they need
well,
to.
Well, the hope springs eternal that we can find somewhere under a pillow or somewhere a pot of gold that will pay our way out of this. In addition to which, Clinton has not been at all backward about simply playing the class warfare card. He has gone out and done his best to suggest that the rich were not paying what he called their fair share of the taxes. Although, actually, I believe that a surprisingly small fraction, I've got what it is, something on the order of 2%, pays half of all the taxes in the country anyway already. He never said what was fair. He just left you to feel that, don't worry, brother, this isn't going to hit you. It's going to hit the rich guy that you envy anyway. That's called the politics of envy.
Well, it may be the politics of envy, but I think a lot of people are going to find out that when the tax bill comes, that they're going to be considered in the rich class.
That's called the politics of surprise.
What is this new thing he's going to come up with? He's going to take the value of your house and all sorts of other things to make it appear that you'll have to be in a higher level of taxation. There are some incredible formulas that they have what you would pay in the rent on your house if you had to rent it, and all of these things are sort of added on. So if you have any inherent wealth, that puts you immediately into a higher tax bracket, even if you don't have the income.
That's right. However, you know, we don't really know what all is going to pass Congress. I have a feeling, for example, that which has been very much pounced on and chewed up might just get dropped somewhere along the line.
Well,
it's really up to Clinton anyway. What passes here, it's up to the Congress of the United States. And although they're Democrats, too, and want very much to please him, they, above all, want to get reelected themselves. They know who, as I said, there's no Republican president to point to at this stage of the game.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, it appeared that all of his programs would have clear sailing, but his demand for gays in the military, now apparently not only the Senate, but now the House that could come out firmly against that. And that's really quite a slap in the face of the new president. That was one of the first things he tried to push through. And it appears even many of the Democrats who ordinarily he'd expect to back him are not going to back him on that issue.
Yes, I hadn't heard that the House had acted on the, as the Senate did, 76-23 to, was that the vote on what is it the House has done here?
Well, I don't know. My son was telling me this evening that apparently the House is anticipated the House is going to vote down that. And that's just secondhand. I actually haven't read that in paper yet.
I hadn't heard it, but you're quite right that the it was a funny first foot to put forward, wasn't it?
It certainly was.
I think that he simply didn't anticipate the amount of opposition that he would run into. I doubt very much that he would have pushed the issue quite as hard, even in the campaign, if he had realized it. Although, of course, he wanted in the campaign to signal his sympathy to that particular group.
Well, now, even if the Republicans had been elected, and they had a majority in the House and the Senate, how in heaven's name is any political organization going to begin to bring the deficit and begin to bring the debt under control? I mean, of course, it sounds very easy to say we're going to cut spending, but, you know, there's so many entitlement programs, there's so many special interest groups, whether it's the farmers who grow mohair or the farmers who grow tobacco, or everybody wants to cut government spending as long as it's not their share of the government largesse.
Well, this morning's New York Times lead editorial spoke approvingly, for a wonder, of a proposal brought forward by the Republicans on the House Ways and Means Committee, headed by Congressman Kasich, I believe, of Ohio, in which they specifically proposed cuts that would reduce the federal deficit by $400 billion over 5 years without raising taxes at all. So let's not say it can't be done, or even that the Republicans haven't gotten specific, which was the point of the Times editorial. They said that criticism is no longer valid. The Republicans have come forward with a counterproposal, and the Democrats ought to take it seriously and respond to it. It's really more specific than the Democratic proposal.
Yes, I read the same editorial. I thought it was so interesting that apparently Bill Clinton had said to the Republican leadership, well, if you don't like my plan, you come up with a plan. And when they did, I don't think he was too happy.
No, but it also answers the question you were asking, which is, if we had a Republican president and a Republican Congress, how in heavens could this be done? I'm not saying it would be easy, and I'm not even saying that Republicans are such little angels that they would do it in the teeth of criticism. But I do think that the mood of the American people today, particularly as reflected in the large vote for Ross Perot, is of a grim determination to tackle the deficit and to pay extra taxes if necessary. However, there's a very clever little trick that all the pollsters play. They will tell you that President Clinton's plan has a lot of support because the American people say that they are ready to be taxed higher. But the question is always asked, would you be willing to be taxed more highly in order to reduce the deficit? Which the answer is yes. If you, in the case of most people, if you then ask them, though, and they never are asked, do you really believe that this present administration and Congress will, if they raise taxes, use it for the purpose, principally even, or let alone exclusively, of reducing the debt? You'll find out the answer is no. And on those terms, then, are you ready to have your taxes raised? And then it becomes a much different question.
Yes, I notice the pollsters always do that, and they're telling us that, you know, the majority of the people are solidly behind our president, and yet I know even many of the people I talk to who voted for Bill Clinton are already beginning to have certain misgivings about what we have wrought, what we brought about the American public. Well, let me open up our lines here.
I suggest again, I'm now at my desk and at my regular phone, and you have faded a bit again.
All right, how is that doing? That's better. All right.
Leaning away from the microphone occasionally.
All right, well, my producer has to keep me praised. Actually, we've changed the electronic setup here in the studio, so to bring in the four-second delay. We've been getting a few nasty calls, and so this is the new equipment, and we're just a little ill at ease with the way it's set up. But are we coming through all right for you?
Better. Every time I mention it, it gets a little bit better.
All right.
I would like it to be louder still, but I can cope with it, assuming the phone calls come through clearly.
All right, fine. Well, let's see. Remember, our telephone number here is 464-8295. 464-8295, if you'd like to talk to Mr. Rusher, who for many years was the publisher of the National Review magazine, certainly one of our most outstanding conservative publications. How long were you with the National Review?
31 and a half years.
Well, I guess you saw them all come and go then.
Yes, it was a wonderful front row seat at the rise of the conservative movement over those years. I was very glad to have had the opportunity. I left a law practice to become publisher of that little magazine when it had only 16,000 paying subscribers. Today it has, the last I heard, 182,000, which is, for a journal of opinion, simply unheard of. It's no journal of opinion has ever in this country been anywhere that large.
Well, I wonder if the fact they're advertising on the Rush Limbaugh program has boosted their circulation.
I'm sure it has helped, but I don't think it was due. It was attributable to the whole 182,000.
No, of course
been
not.
Rising quite rapidly over the past 3 years, and they only began advertising on him fairly recently. But I don't want to take away from the Rush Limbaugh program.
Well, I think Rush certainly has done a great deal to mobilize the conservative movement.
He sure has.
And to point out some of the absurdities of the liberal position. And, you know, I love his ridicule. I love the television clips where, you know, he shows you what the people really said. And I love his one reference to symbolism over substance. And so often this is what we see. In fact, he had an interview with Les Aspin the other evening, and where they were talking about the food and medical supply drops into Bosnia. And Les Aspin said, well, this is symbolic. And Rush picked up on that, and he said, this is symbolism.
We're dropping food. I had people interviewed on his program. I hadn't heard any, except to call in.
Oh, well, what he does, he has a television program now.
Yeah, it's on at 2 in the morning.
Right, well, of course, we get it here at 10:30. We just get off our program. We bring it in on satellite out of Denver. And so after I finish the program, I go in and put my feet up on a stool, and I listen to Rush Limbaugh and then turn in. But now he takes these film clips of various interviews, perhaps with a television reporter. Les Aspin being interviewed on one of the major networks and saying, this is symbolism. And, of course, this is symbolism. The tragedy is, as far as I'm concerned, in Bosnia is we've got an arms embargo on there. They can't defend themselves, and we drop them food from airplanes. you know, I think that there's a great deal of inconsistency here.
Before we get away from Limbaugh, Joe Sobran had a wonderful column just in the last day or two in which he said, you know, these liberals are greedy. They have control of the presidency. They have control of the Congress. They apparently have control of the Supreme Court. They have all of the major television networks, all the major news magazines, all the major national newspapers, but they don't control Rush Limbaugh, and they want it all. They simply can't stand the fact that he has this huge audience.
I'll say, well, he's captured the imagination of the conservatives unlike any other individual I've ever seen. For a time, Morton Downey Jr. had a fairly good conservative following, but he was a little vulgar.
Yeah, he was just too flaky.
He really was. You know, he said a lot of the right things, but he was hard even for a hardline conservative to swallow. Well, look, we've got a caller here on line two, so let's ask Marge to come on with us. Marge, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, fine. And
turn up your thing a little bit more?
You mean me?
Yeah, I could barely hear you.
How is that now? Is that coming through better?
All
right, fine. So, do you have a question or comment from Mr.
Well, Rutgers? I have two questions, basically, and one of them is that I know during Clinton's campaign he kept saying that he was going to raise the taxes on the rich because they weren't paying their taxes and all this. But I'm not really talking about the major companies because they usually have a tax write-offs and they don't have to worry about it. But I'm talking about some of the independent rich. Okay, why would, I'm not saying all of them had supported him, but why were some of the single ones supporting him, knowing that they that their taxes were going to be raised?
You mean why would some of the more wealthy people support him?
Right.
All right, what would your reply to that be?
Well, I suppose each case has to be judged individually, but I think, for example, of Barbara Streisand, who surely makes an awful lot of money, and practically wove herself into a doormat for Clinton. I suppose that, particularly in Hollywood, I think a lot of those people suspect rightly that they don't really deserve all the money that pours in on them, in the sense that it is not terribly connected with any equivalent amount of effort pouring out of them, at least in many cases. And that there is therefore a large unconscious guilt floating around, and that they work this out to some degree by becoming ultra-liberal in their politics, which enables them to appear to themselves to be compassionate and caring, while in fact not really hurting them all that much. Yes, Barbara Streisand's taxes are going to go up a little bit, but I don't think they'll go up by any degree that she'll either notice or care much about. And if they did, I think she'd squawk pretty loud. What was your second question?
Well, going on to the first question, it seems to me that if they're not that worried about getting taxed, or if they are, whatever, but why is it then as every time she speaks into an AIDS foundation, they pay her the enormous amount of money just because of her stardom?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that very clearly.
Well, I think her question is, when Barbara Streisand addresses a large AIDS group, and of course she's quite a supporter of the gay movement, they seem to pay her a great deal of money, and I didn't quite understand what the concern was there.
My concern is that isn't that being a little bit hypocritical on her part?
I'm not sure that she's paid for those particular appearances. I've assumed, at any rate, that she wasn't. Those were sort of charity. My God, if she's getting paid for them, I would agree with you there's a little bit of hypocrisy, but I would check that first, because I think probably she gives her services.
I suspect she does, Marge. I don't think she's getting paid to...
Well, then some of my reports have been very wrong, then.
Well, why don't you document them, and then you give us a call later.
I told you just what I had assumed. I could be wrong.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, then I better recheck it.
Okay, fine.
And there's another question that I wanted to try to figure out, because this whole campaign was so confusing, it was pathetic. And not on George Bush, because I still support the man, even though he's made a few mistakes. One thing that I can't figure out let's put it this way, Slick Willie, is that when... I was out on the street, just kind of walking around, and during the election day, they kept the welfare people kept giving me papers in support of Bill Clinton. And he made a statement that he was going to pass a bill where the welfare people have 2 years to get a job or they'll be off. Now, I know half these people do not want to work. Now, why are they supporting him on this basis?
All right, Jeff.
I think they don't take probably very seriously his threats to do anything about welfare. Traditionally, the Democratic Party has been the party of welfare, and I would be myself rather surprised if they turned out to be anything else. I think that was mostly campaign rhetoric. And here, once again, Clinton has a reasonably good cover, although he and the Congress are of the same party, so at least we know which party is responsible. But he can say, well, the Congress wouldn't do this, you know.
Well, of course, I think that what he's suggesting is that at the end of 2 years, they will provide a job for these people. In other words, it's sort of like it is in other socialist countries. Mm-hmm. If they can't find a job, we'll have make-work situations. And, of course, that's a disaster.
Yes, I have to admit that. Incidentally, I think his rhetoric mostly suggested the jobs would be available in the private sector, but that remains very much to be seen.
In fact, as we keep cutting back on the defense industry and more people are thrown out of work, and we begin closing the bases, there are going to be all these people out looking for work. I think the unemployment rates are going to skyrocket. And then now he's going to spend money to make the jobs for the people that he's throwing out of work by his cutbacks. And he seems to think that government can solve all of our problems, and he doesn't seem to realize it's private industry, it's the private entrepreneur that creates jobs, not government.
Yes, you know, during the campaign, I debated former Senator Proxmire in Oswego, New York, and that evening I happened upon a formula that the audience seemed to understand and appreciate rather well. That is this: in a free society, you can't have employees without having employers.
That's so obvious.
They will hound employers and impose new regulations on them and tax them right up to the eyebrows and have a wonderful time thinking, boy, we're really beating up on business, aren't we? And then cry their eyes out because there are so many unemployed.
Well, of course, you know.
I have a funny feeling it's going to be somewhat like or even worse than what Jimmy Carter put us through those 4 years, because I could remember at that time there was more unemployment than has ever been in the history of the United States. He had put more people out of jobs than anybody could shake a stick at. I remember Walt couldn't find a job at that time. It was until after the Reagan administration when he did a lot of cutbacks in the government, and within a few months he got a job, and it took us a year and a half, and he didn't have any physical problems or anything like that.
Sure. Well, I think we may look back on the Carter administration as the good old days. Anyway, thanks so much for calling, Marge.
Okay. There was something I was going to say, too, but it kind of slipped my mind. But
okay, fine. Well, we'll look forward to hearing from you maybe tomorrow.
No, okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And let's get our telephone numbers again. That's 464-8295, 464-8295, if you'd like to call and talk to Mr. Rusher. Tell me, what do you think about our invasion, or at least our intervention in Somalia?
Well, I was originally reluctantly for it. It's a very mixed question. In general, I favor deploying American troops, putting American soldiers in harm's way only when the American vital interest is involved, as I think, for example, it was involved in August 1990 when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. I wasn't interested in saving democracy in Kuwait. There was no democracy in Kuwait to save. What I was interested in, though, was the fact that if Saddam Hussein at that point, with the army that he had available to him then, had simply rolled down the Persian Gulf, taken Saudi Arabia as he could have in the oil emirates, he would have had altogether the lion's share of the oil of the Middle East, and with that he could have brought Japan and Western Europe to their knees in a month. Now that was a strategic threat to the world order that the United States simply could not abide, and President Bush, I think, took exactly the right action, and very brilliant action, to take care of. But I did let myself get persuaded, I think mostly by myself, that those terrible pictures of starving children on CNN simply were more than a human being could bear. We could send food. Certainly, we did do that. But then, of course, the problem became that the food wasn't getting through. The so-called warlords were blocking it and confiscating it. So that, as I say, was a mixed question, and I could see the case for intervening and seeing to it that the food got to the people who needed it. But now, what do we see? We see a situation in which American Marines have died and others have died there in what was called Operation Rescue or something like that. It has turned out to be a military action with many hostile people sniping at the Marines and hiding weapons and one thing and another. So that I think that if I had seen more clearly or simply been a little bit sterner about it, I might even have opposed aid to Somalia. More precisely, not aid to Somalia. I would have favored food if it could get through. But sending people to die so that it should get through? No. No, that I would not be for.
Well, you know, the things that disturbed me about Somalia, first of all, they're starving people in the Sudan, they're starving people in Ethiopia, they're starving people throughout all of Africa, and if we got pictures of all of them, we would have a feeling maybe we ought to send troops into all the countries of Africa.
And then we'd be very likely to do it the way we're acting.
But one of the things, there have been several articles, Los Angeles Times carried an article saying that there are tremendous oil interests in Somalia, and four of our major oil corporations have concessions there, at least they had concessions before the government was overthrown, and that's the real reason they're there. Do you think there's any basis for that?
I haven't heard that, and it may well be an oil concession. It's merely a right to dig in a hole to see if you can find oil. I haven't heard, and I don't believe, as a matter of fact, that there's any serious amount of oil ever been discovered in Somalia, and I doubt very much that that's at the bottom of this. I think that what's at the bottom of it is the CNN coverage in advance of the starving children. I think that the politicians are listening, as always, to the heartbeat of America, heard it pound a little bit harder and a little bit faster for those pitiful children, and acted as politicians will.
Let me give our telephone numbers here again, 464-8295. That's 464-8295. If you'd like to call, have a question, or make a comment. One of the things that disturbed me reading the New York Times was that several of our Marines now are on trial for the use of excessive force. And, of course, you know, when you're in a situation, somebody comes up, they're throwing something at your truck, you don't know if it's a rock or a grenade. Sometimes soldiers react. All they have is a high-powered rifle. They don't have shotguns or anything else. And here we have one sergeant on trial for murder, another one, on trial for use of excessive force. I would think that would be terribly bad as far as the morale, terribly destructive to the morale of our armed forces.
It may well be, and it certainly makes it extremely difficult for the soldiers whom we've placed over there to know how far they can go without getting court-martialed for having gone too far. Once again, a good argument for not going. You know, if we hadn't been there, this wouldn't have happened.
Sure. And then, of course, now there's the talk about Bosnia, and it's the same thing. You know, the starving Bosnians, the rape.
The Bosnian situation is, if anything, though, infinitely worse. It is not a question of a simple question of starving people. It's a question of a civil war, basically. The Yugoslav Republic has fallen apart, and its component parts are playing a game of grab here to see which of them can get the most. They are all mixed up ethnically and religiously. The plan that Vance and Owens have come up with proposes 10, count them, 10 separate ethnic enclaves in Bosnia alone, which itself is just an enclave in the larger former Yugoslavia. Now, all this is supposed to inspire us to dash in with the good old infantry again and solve the problem of Yugoslavia. It will cost human lives, American lives, and every one of them to me is far too precious to waste on a thing which does not have a strategic involvement for us. I don't care whether New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis can stand it or not. Let him suffer. Or let him go over there and stop it if he's so eager to. But certainly there is no reason on earth why we should do any more than we're doing, which is, as you quoted Secretary Aspen as saying, purely symbolic. We're just throwing food and medical supplies out of airplanes down into the darkness and hoping some of it lands where it'll do some good, and I hope it does some good. But if we go from there, the next step, into military involvement, as we may, then we are, I think, on our way to becoming the fireman, policeman, and nanny of the world.
And we have a call coming in here on line two. We'll get the background of that. Yeah, one of the things I think that many people are concerned about now is the Rodney King trial and the threats of violence that seem to be coming up. You know, if the jury were to acquit the police officers of culpability as far as the beating is concerned, many of the leaders of the black community are threatening that there are going to be major demonstrations and violence. So what is your response to that?
Well, at least they tell us this time. I think the world was caught by surprise. Certainly the Los Angeles police were last time. There will be no excuses about surprise this time. I think it's very foolish to threaten that kind of thing anyway, because it does that kind of violence the last time did more damage to the black community in Los Angeles, Lord knows, than to anybody else, perhaps the Korean community. But I'm so convinced that this is a case of really basically double jeopardy anyway, that I can't think much more about it. I know, having been a lawyer before I turned to a life of crime and became a magazine publisher, that the courts have ruled that it is not technically double jeopardy, but they have ruled it merely because it is used in these very few cases where the federal government needs another crack at a particular situation for some political purpose of its own. And that's what's being done in this particular case. These men were tried for this crime and acquitted of it, and that certainly annoyed an awful lot of people and let us assume for the moment that it was a mistaken verdict, although I have no way really of knowing. But if it was, at any rate it was the verdict of the jury, and under our system should have been respected as such. Instead, they are being tried for it all over again on the pretense that what they're being tried for is not the crime of having beaten Rodney King, but of having conspired with a mutual intent to deprive him of his civil rights. Now, that is just fancy legalese for doing it all over again, and in better days, under better Supreme Courts, it would have been ruled double jeopardy, which it most certainly is, and that, as we know, is traditionally, in the long tradition of English and American law, regarded as injustice.
Well, you know, there were so many statements made. One of them was made by Tom Bradley, the mayor of Los Angeles, who, you know, just as the riots were starting, went on television and said, you know, if there's no justice, there's not going to be any peace. And it would almost appear that he was acting irresponsibly to more or less justify the tragedy of what was going on. And certainly, in the same way, certain people in the administration were saying, well, we're going to see that we really have a fair trial. We're going to have another trial right off. And they were in the process of burning down Los Angeles. And there was so much talk in the media about, well, you have to understand the rage of the people, as if somehow this justified the lawlessness, 10,000 fires, $1 billion in damage,
well,
50
of course,
deaths.
It wouldn't have justified it even if it had been rage, but I don't think it was. 99% of what went on was simply a seized opportunity to loot.
I think that sums it up better than anything I've heard. I think it was just lawlessness. In fact, the pictures we saw of the people, most of them looked like they were having a good time stealing television sets. I mean, they weren't stealing food.
What the verdict did was simply suspend or persuade them that there had been suspended the obligation to behave.
Sure. Well, let me give our telephone numbers here again, just once more, 464-8295, 464-8295. And usually we have all sorts of callers here, but I guess most people are probably afraid to ask you a question because you put things forward so clearly and concisely.
I'm sorry if we're not pulling tonight. I generally have no trouble. The callers are there.
They're out there, and I'm sure we have. Usually what they do is they wait until just about 3 minutes before the news,
yeah,
and then they all call in at the last minute. Well, one of the things that we hear a great deal about is the danger of the national debt. You know, with a $4 trillion on-budget debt, and certainly a great deal more than that off-budget as far as Social Security money that is owed, but there's just no way to pay it, federal pensions, and some people suggest that the real debt is not $4 trillion, but, you know, $10, $11 trillion. Is there any way that we're ever going to be able to pay that off without just massively inflating it away? How can a civilized society pay back a sum of money of that magnitude?
Well, I've spent my entire life being concerned about the national debt. I don't feel at all comfortable about turning around now in my dotage and saying that it doesn't matter. It does matter. The most important and difficult part of it is paying the interest on it. The principal on the national debt is not anything that is going to afflict us anytime soon, but that isn't to say that it isn't important, because the principal is getting so large that the interest is getting, it is now the second largest item in the federal budget, and there is no way, short of repudiating the credit of the United States, to avoid paying that interest. And of course, the more debt we pile up, the more interest we pile up. Against that, it is fair to ask the question, I think, what exactly is this national debt as a proportion of the gross national product? This is, you know, it isn't really fair to take the administration of George Washington or even Abraham Lincoln and compare the federal debt, such as it was under either of them, to what it is today. It's a different country. It's a far bigger country. This country, since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the disappearance of the Soviet Union, is now, I think, about the third largest in population on Earth. And it has a whale of an economy. And you can only compare effectively what the debt was at earlier times to what the gross national product was in those times. I think you will find that my figures are a little out of date, because I haven't checked them up in the last two or three years, but as of at any rate about 1989, the national debt of the United States as a percentage of the gross national product was actually smaller than it had been in the Ford administration in 1975. So we must, when the economy grows, of course, everything is going to grow, including the amount of debt that we take on. But that is not to be cavalier about it. I don't want to be understood as saying it doesn't matter, because there is that fact of the hard nut of the interest that has to be paid every year on that debt, and that will become, if it doesn't get curbed pretty soon, the largest single item in the budget, and that, of course, is just money that has to be spent on that and can't be spent on anything else.
And, of course, one of the things that some people point out is that if we keep growing at the same level, in other words, we keep increasing the debt as we have, I remember here Congressman Dannemeyer one time saying that, you know, within about 15 years, all the money that comes in to the national treasury would go to pay the national debt.
Well, I hadn't heard that it's gotten quite that bad. I say that I understand that it might become in the relatively near future the largest single item in the national budget, but I don't know that it would consume all of the money that the federal government could. I suppose it could if you extrapolated enough and made enough gloomy assumptions, you might very well get there.
Well, let's hope that the politicians in Washington, D.C. see this problem and begin addressing it. And certainly I think that Ross Perot brought this out very vividly.
Yes, I don't think it's so much whether they see it. I think they know the American people care about it. As Senator Henry Ashurst of Arizona, who was quite a colorful old fellow, once said when he changed his vote on something, they said, "Well, Senator, we're glad you saw the light." He said, "I didn't see the light. I felt the heat." People are, the politicians in Washington haven't seen the light. They couldn't see the light if you shined a flashlight in their eyes. But boy, they can feel the heat.
Well, I think that's really what hopefully is going to happen. More and more people are going to get concerned, and they're going to let the politicians know they're not going to get reelected if they don't do what's really responsible.
In that connection, Perot, by the way, may, the way he's behaving, he intends to keep their feet to the fire. It's going to be very interesting to see how he develops. Now that there is a Democratic president to go with the Democratic Congress, it's going to be a little bit hard for him to concentrate all of his fusillades on the Republican Party, which he did, I think, in the last election, mostly because he disliked Bush personally.
Right. Well, let's take a call here. We have Tony from Capitola. Well, let's see if we can get through Tony. Tony, I think you're going to have to call in on another line. Let's try it once more and just see if we can get you through. Nope, I'm afraid we got a bad connection there. One of the things that is of some concern is to talk about a constitutional convention to control the debt. In other words, people say, well, what we need is a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution so the politicians can't keep spending us into oblivion. How do you feel about a constitutional convention?
I've not been afraid of it. I know that Phyllis Schlafly, my good friend and fellow conservative, is very much against the idea of a constitutional convention because she thinks it could get out of hand and go and do all sorts of injudicious things. I may be too populistic in this, but I trust the people a little bit more than that. I think that it's mostly the liberals who fear a constitutional convention. They do it because they know deep down in their guts that they haven't got a majority or anything like it, the American people on their side, even now. Clinton only got 43% of the vote, remember. So they are not about to applaud the idea of putting such a weapon in the hands of people who haven't been to Harvard.
Let's see if we can get this line on now. Yeah, there we are. Tony, you're with us.
Hi.
Hi, thank you so much for calling. How are you tonight?
I'm a subscriber of National Review Magazine. It's one of my favorites, so I'm pretty excited to speak to William Rusher.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear you. Speak up a little bit now so we can...
I'm a very great fan of Bill Buckley as well. I've heard him speak and I've read several of his novels and of his other writings, including some works that he did way back in the 1950s, and he's just spectacular.
Yes.
The question that I have for you has to do with our Labor Secretary, Robert Reich.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, his plans to create jobs, will that plan work, or is this just more government jobs?
The question is whether or not Reich's plan to increase employment will work. Is that right?
Yeah, because he seems to want to create a lot of jobs, but to me, all these jobs are just more government jobs, and I think one of the problems we have in the country right now is government is too big.
Well, Dr. Monteith raised that question earlier of what kind of jobs this administration is planning to create anyway. The, the lingo goes, the song, if you listen to what they sing, is that they're going to create a lot of private sector jobs, but if they don't, if that doesn't work, then they'll give them government-made work to do. Even that would be a novelty because a great many of these people on welfare, as the lady mentioned earlier, aren't very much inclined to do work for anybody, either government or private industry. But I doubt very much that Reich is doing much more than simply following the Clinton formula of promises here. I've watched Reich. He's essentially a man who... is all in favor of what he calls industrial policy, but that really means government control of the economy. I debated him once. He's a very entertaining man. As you know, I think he's a good deal less than 5 feet tall.
Yes, I believe he's 4'10".
And he said, making a joke of himself, he said, you know, when I began discussing economics, I was 6 feet tall. Kind of cute. But on that particular occasion of the debate, I remember he had written something a few years before, which was, to say the least, injudicious. I'm sorry, I've forgotten what it was, but I had the quote there. And in the question period, I said, Professor Reich, I read this to him, I said, if you had your life to live over again, would you write that? And he paused, and the audience listened for about 10 seconds, and he said, no.
Yeah. Well, he wrote very favorably of Soviet planning in the 1930s. And this was a period when Stalin was running around in the Ukraine and the Kazakh collectivizing farms and liquidating opposition, literally, by killing people.
Well, I don't think that Reich favors liquidating people, and I don't think that's the point, and I don't think that's your point. I think the criticism of Reich is that he has never gotten over the idea that government is a great, big, wonderful agency for doing all sorts of good things, including telling people how to run their economic lives.
Right.
And as long as he remains of that frame of mind, he's a dangerous man fundamentally, although certainly I think a well-intentioned one.
Yeah. Well, I would agree with you there. I know one of the plans of the Clinton administration is to create hundreds of thousands of part-time summer jobs. And I don't know how you feel, but I don't think we need more leaf rakers in the national parks. I mean, I don't see how that trains people for work in the technological future.
I hadn't heard that he was in favor of part-time summer jobs. I thought that Clinton's whole idea was that all the
You know, in Ronald Reagan's terms, they produced 21 million jobs.
Right.
The Democrats are, well, poo-poo, those were all McDonald's, McJobs, as they called them. They weren't, this, by the way, wasn't true. Most of them, the majority of them, in fact, were highly trained jobs.
Well, we're going to have to take a break here. We're about a minute.
Yeah. Well, I'm a subscriber to the National Review, and... you know, I get it regularly, and I read most of it, but I got to say I'm really upset with him. And so I hope you don't mind an antagonistic question.
Not in the least. I haven't been publisher of it for about 4 years now.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess you're off the hook then.
I'm off the hook.
Well, make your comment anyway, Tony.
Well,
I'd
like to know, like, why, in your opinion, did the National Review come out against the parental choice or school voucher initiative in the last issue? You know, as a conservative, this is like kind of a darling issue. I mean,
well, I remember, so let me deal with the one on school vouchers. The National Review itself is not against school vouchers. They're very much for them. There is, however, an argument which libertarians tend to make, the libertarian wing of the conservative movement, which fears that if you let the government start providing even vouchers, they'll get their nose like a camel under the tent, and the next thing you know, they'll be running the private schools of the country. And I think that John O'Sullivan, the editor of National Review, simply thought that that point of view was interesting enough and maybe had enough merit that it deserved an article. But you will find, I don't know where it is, I haven't got a copy by me, but there is, I think, in every issue, a statement, there used to be, that the views of the authors of signed articles do not necessarily represent the point of view of National Review. We once had a lady, another libertarian, as it happened, who wrote an article, a very interesting one, which she said that taxes ought to be voluntary. She was opposed to the compulsory payment of taxes because she thought everybody would chip in anyway, like that little kid in Fargo, North Dakota.
Yeah, he needed to have his head examined.
and the bake sales. Don't forget about the bake sales where people are sending all their the proceeds from the bake sales to the president.
Right. Well, you know, Clinton endorses
really buy her
sending cookies
April 15th.
We thought
it was amusing and interesting, and she wrote it well, so we ran the article. And I think that's what happened in this particular case. National Review is very pro-voucher.
Well, you know, I'm glad to hear that, but I was kind of disturbed about the article because, like, in California, we're going to have that on the ballot here come June 94.
Before June 94, National Review, I predict, will weigh in with all sorts of endorsements for
that. Well, that's good because, you know, there's all kinds of guarantees written into this initiative to keep exactly that from happening.
Yes.
In fact,
now, I think that the school vouchers are a good idea, and as far as I'll be very surprised if National Review says anything else.
Okay, well, if, then I won't cancel my subscription.
No,
at
don't do that.
No, you never cancel your subscription for just one or two articles. If most of them are good, why, you take the good, and because nobody is going to be right all the time. Not even here on Radio Liberty.
Okay, well, I'm not going to say nothing about that. Can I ask another question?
Yeah, sure.
Sure you can. Go ahead. And let me give our numbers here once more, though. They're 464-8295. That's 464-8295 if you'd like to call in with a comment or question.
Well, a lot of us conservatives are concerned, and I think a lot of Americans, too, about a constitutional convention. And I know this is really kind of a really far-fetched idea, but what if we call the Constitutional Convention and decided to go back to the original Constitution? All of these interpretations that the Supreme Court has given us that did not, that fly directly in the face of what the Founding Fathers wanted, that we, you know, we've been forced to abide by and have shoved down our throats, taking out prayer in the school, the myth of separation of church and state, the Federal Reserve Board, representatives limited down to 435. I mean, I go on and on. I mean, what are the chances of saying, hey, there's nothing wrong with the Constitution, it's just been these stupid Supreme Court justices we've had. Let's go back and live by the Constitution. What do you think the chances are of that happening? Probably
none.
I don't
know how it would come up before a constitutional convention. It would presumably be in the form of a motion. What would your motion be? I move that what?
We go back to the original intent of the Constitution.
No, but that is... that is a conclusion, really. It's not a specific proposal for action. I don't see that that would achieve what you want to achieve. But let me address more generally the question, the idea that you have. personally, as I've said, I'm not afraid of the judgment of the American people or of the delegates that they would elect to a constitutional convention. I don't think they'd be a runaway bunch at all. But I do think that you would find a good deal more caution among them than you're getting now in terms than you are suggesting in terms of throwing over certain findings of the Supreme Court that you and I may not like. I think there is a caution in the American people. I think that they do not want to go too far, and I think that is wise. I don't think that it would be a good idea to wrench the country too far from the moorings that have been developed over 200 years here.
Hmm.
We have to take these things slowly and by degrees.
How many? I'm not really knowledgeable on the makeups of the state assemblies. I would guess that Arizona, Utah, South Carolina maybe Louisiana have state assemblies that would have a conservative majority.
There are more states than that have conservative majorities, but incidentally, most states are dominated by Democratic legislatures.
Right, but are there enough states to have? Suppose if there were a constitutional convention, and the original convention I seem to remember required unanimous consent of the 13 colonies for ratification. But if it were to go to say 3/4, how many states could we count on as far as sticking up for conservative principles and not jettisoning
the... Well, principles, I don't think you can... It's very hard to answer in the abstract. I do think that we know that so far as a balanced budget amendment is concerned, that very nearly 3/4 of the states, I think all minus 2 at the moment, I think we're still 2 short, have already adopted that. So that will give you some idea of the flavor of the mindset of the legislatures. But it would depend on each case. What I would like to see is something that could be done actually by the Supreme Court or perhaps by constitutional amendment, and that is to make the 9th and 10th Amendments real again.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Because they are simply ignored, these things which say that the federal government shall only have the powers which it is specifically granted, that all other powers are retained to the states or to the people.
And that is really the very essence of the Constitution.
It is, and of course they've had to ignore it to get where they got.
Well, a good example going on right now is down there in Texas, in Waco. And, you know, and I don't condone, you know, this cult down there, but in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, limits the federal government to the District of Columbia. And here we have a federal agency moving into a state. Same thing happened with that Operation Rescue with Judge Kelly. And the Supreme Court said, no, you don't have jurisdiction there. I mean, it was a close vote. It was 5-4, but, you know, I was glad that the Supreme Court said that the federal government didn't have jurisdiction there. And now they're doing it again. And,
the FBI's participation?
Pardon me?
Are you talking about the FBI's participation?
No, it's the alcohol, firearms, and tobacco.
Well,
because this is a state matter, I would think.
The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms is enforcing existing federal law, if that's what you're talking about. Now, maybe there shouldn't be such federal laws, or maybe you think all such federal laws are unconstitutional. I don't know.
Well, I think that's the idea of the 9th and 10th Amendment. All powers not specifically herein given to the Congress are reserved to the states and the people, and there was nothing there that gave them the right to regulate, you know, within the individual states, alcohol and tobacco.
I see.
Well, at least there's some people who would feel very strongly, and I think that's the point that Tony's making, isn't that it, Tony?
Well, I agree with Mr. Rusher, and I also agree that the Founding Fathers, when they sat down to talk about the Constitution, if anybody said anything about a federal government coming in and regulating the individual states, they would have never put their signatures on the paper.
Sure. Okay.
It would never have happened.
Right. Okay, fine. Well, did you have any other points?
That's about it. Thank you for your guest.
Thank you so very much. Let me give our numbers once again. That's 464-8295. And let's go to line 2 for Dick and Soquel. Dick?
Yeah, Dick and Capitola.
Dick and Capitola.
How are you gentlemen this evening?
We're doing just fine, thanks.
Well, good. I wanted to pick up on the idea of the vouchers and the article that ran, and, of course, the bigger picture, which is the idea of communicating what might be considered a minority view. This, I'm sure there are some left-wing publications that have articles that some of the more extreme, we might say, what are you doing that for? And a name that both of you would know, I'm sure, is Rusis Rushduni. Wrote an article that I read on the vouchers and articulated the idea that that has been around since time immemorial, when conservatives want something from government, there's always been that voice that's come in and said, well, if we do that, then with assistance comes control. But so I wanted to just throw out Russ Dooney's name as one. I still lean, and I think, in favor of the vouchers. I haven't been asked to vote on it lately, but anyway, how about the bigger issue for Mr. Rusher, the idea of when are some lines drawn, and maybe he could give some interesting examples when he was the publisher of some types of articles that are run that might not be the down the line conservative view, and yet the powers that be felt, well, this is something though that should be communicated.
Oh, that happens all the time. I gave one example of the lady who wanted taxes to be voluntary. That's about as far out, I think, as we ever got in the libertarian direction. Buckley himself has a certain number of what I call lost leaders, things that in which his position is not the usual conservative position, although some conservatives agree with him. I think most would not favor the legalization of marijuana, which he favors.
Buckley favors it?
Yeah. He favors it because of the decriminalization, more precisely, because he feels that you can't stop it anyway and you're just providing a criminal traffic which you could get rid of. And I think that goes for other drugs as well, although I don't want to speak for him, and I'm sure it wouldn't go for heroin or something like that.
What about prostitution?
I'm not sure, but what he wouldn't take the position that, after all, it's legalized in France or places like that where they have medical inspections and that kind of thing. Some states of the country, as a matter of fact, I believe, one or two. But I don't want to put words in Bill Buckley's mouth. The point is that he does have his own set of opinions, and from time to time he would let the magazine editors differ with him, or sort of make it to each his own type of situation. Sometimes he would decree what was the position of the magazine. He owned all the voting stock, so he could do what he wanted.
let me bring up a point. Many conservatives were very, very disheartened before the last election, when during the primary Bill Buckley came out with a rather vicious attack on Pat Buchanan, and really more or less discredited his candidacy among conservatives. And many conservatives felt that, you know, Mr. Bush, President Bush, didn't really represent their views. But that they're very resentful of Bill Buckley's position, and really defaming Buchanan and calling him a racist and all of the things that that the liberal media were calling him. Do you have any comment on that, or would that be a good thing to stay away from?
No, I don't think there's any reason to stay away from it. I think you have not quite accurately, though, described what Bill did. And this is partly Bill's fault, because what he did was a little bit hard to follow. He wrote this long article in search of anti-Semitism, which he ran in National Review. And he discussed various situations that touched on the subject of anti-Semitism, the charges of anti-Semitism against the Dartmouth Review, the conservative publication of Dartmouth, which were flatly untrue and which he said were untrue, the charges of anti-Semitism against Gore Vidal for his publications in The Nation magazine. Now, Buckley detests Vidal, and he confirmed that, in his opinion, Vidal was and is anti-Semitic. He discussed the problem of Joe Sobran, who
had written things in his own column, not in National Review, which various people understood to be anti-Semitic, which Bill defended Sobran against. Then he came to the question of Buchanan, and I was amused in reading the article at how he got as involuted as only Buckley can get. There was sort of a triple negative involved. He said that he was found himself unable to defend Buchanan against the charge that some of the things that he had said were susceptible of the imputation of anti-Semitism, something like that. And then turned right around, and this you have forgotten, turned right around within a matter of weeks after that came out and endorsed Buchanan in the New Hampshire primary for President of the United States.
No. See, that's what the articles I read didn't mention, so I didn't realize he actually had endorsed him.
Well, the National Review endorsed it, and I assure you they wouldn't. I think he personally did too in his column.
All right,
now,
fine.
He made it clear that he was not endorsing Buchanan all the way down the line. He thought that a signal ought to be given to Bush in the New Hampshire primary. But you can imagine what Abe Rosenthal and the New York Times, both of which had said that Buckley had accused Buchanan of anti-Semitism, when Buckley said, "I did not," and then followed it up by endorsing him for President of the United States.
Well, then I'm very glad you clarified that for our listeners. Because
I repeat that Buckley's endorsement of Buchanan was for that time and that primary only. But it certainly was inconsistent with any idea. He wouldn't have done it for New Hampshire alone if he had really thought that Pat Buchanan was anti-Semitic.
No, and I think that poor Pat got a bad rap.
He did. He got a very bad rap, and I think he's still a bit grouchy about it, for which I understand perfectly.
All right, but Dick, did you have any other comments or questions?
Well, that pretty much dealt with it. I was, of course, thinking in terms of when a publication has certain expectations from its readers, and particularly conservatives wanting a conservative publication, and then there seem to be almost party line issues.
Tell you, if you're running a magazine, a National Review was always criticized for being too predictable. This is a country that loves a little uncertainty. You read New Republic today, and you find out what I'm talking about. That used to be a liberal magazine. Now you turn a page, and you don't know what the devil is going to be on that page. It very often is something very conservative. They've run articles I wish National Review would run.
Well, let me run something else by you. Something, this really is sort of past history, but I think it was during the Carter administration when we were turning the Panama Canal over to the Panamanian government. And as I recall, National Review, or at least Bill Buckley, seemed to support the giveaway of the canal, and there
very
were many...
Very good example. Yes, he did. He endorsed the Panama Canal Treaty, absolutely, and required National Review to do it, too.
And there were a lot of conservatives who were furious with him.
Including me.
What
Buckley,
was his rationale?
Buckley didn't mind that. He always, when somebody would write in a flaming letter condemning him for something, he would turn it over to me, and I was supposed to write back and say, well, now, you and I disagree with Mr. Buckley about this, but on the whole, he tends to be conservative.
Do you have any idea what motivated him to take that position?
Well, there's something rattling around in the back of my head that there was a Roman Catholic Archbishop of Panama with an Irish name, whom Buckley happened at one point to talk to. This was probably years before the treaty. And this man apparently convinced Bill that it would be the best thing, all things considered, to do this. That's one influence on him that I remember having heard about, and I'm sorry I can't remember the name of the archbishop, but certainly it's the kind of thing that might happen, that might persuade him.
Sure, it might.
And secondly, he is and has been for many years very close to Henry Kissinger, who, as you know, was up to his ears in the negotiation of that treaty, although it finally came to pass in Carter's administration. But it had been working its way through the Ford and Nixon White Houses, too.
And, okay, well, thank you. I'll get off the air now and let somebody else call in.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks so much, Dick. And our telephone numbers are 464-8295. That's 464-8295 if you'd like to call in and ask Mr. Rusher any questions or bring up any matters. Actually, I really can't expect you to explain Bill Buckley's motivation, buddy. I'm interested in, at least your thoughts as far as that's concerned.
No, I didn't really realize that Bill Buckley was close to Henry Kissinger.
Oh, yes.
Who is really one of the more interesting characters of the last 30 years.
Oh, yes. They're very good friends and have been for 25 years.
Well, let me quickly run over a couple of other questions, which I think many of our listeners would like to know about. How do you feel about the new Clean Air Act, new environmental regulations from the national level, which many conservatives fear are really going to hamstring industry in America?
Well, they may well. I'm not an expert on this field. You wandered into something where I feel a little insecure in that way. But I will tell you, I feel this very strongly, and that is that we conservatives have let the entire issue of environmentalism get away from us. We have got to devise positions. As far as I can see, they haven't yet been devised. At least I haven't heard about them. As to where precisely conservatives come down on these environmental questions. And if we have, it certainly hasn't gotten out and to a point where it can attract the public. The liberals and the left and the greens have occupied all of the moral high ground in this situation. And we have let them get away with it, and we have got to stop and stop soon. I suppose that the ultimately it has seemed to me always that the answer is a trade-off. You have to decide how much of one good you want to give up in order to pursue another good, because these are competing goods. We're not in the business of throwing lumberjacks in the Northwest. I assume we're not out of work. But we don't want at the same time, apparently, to lose the northern spotted owl. So it's a question of, it comes down. There's a wonderful quotation from Emerson in one of his essays in which he says, "What wilt thou have, saith the Lord, take it and pay for it."
Well,
is what we have to do here. How many jobs are we prepared to lose to save the spotted owl? How many million acre feet of water will not go down the Central Valley into Southern California because the Delta smelt needs it, for crying out loud? This is the kind of problem that has to be addressed seriously. And by the way, the Claremont Institute, of which I am now a senior fellow, is going to be holding a conference on this very subject, the development of a conservative position on environmentalism, probably next year. Our big conference this year is going to be on the welfare state and the underclass. I haven't had a chance to mention the Claremont Institute here, but for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's a think tank, a conservative think tank, basically located in Claremont, California, about an hour east of Los Angeles. But I work for it as a senior fellow out of my own apartment and office here in San Francisco. They have a two-man staff and a full office in Sacramento called the Golden State Center for Public Policy, I believe, and that watches the government of the state of California, which Lord knows deserves watching. The state is so much bigger even than the population of Canada by this time. So the Claremont Institute is going to be dealing precisely with this question of environmentalism, and we can't get to it too soon, in my opinion.
Well, I think that the radical left are using the environment as a vehicle for destroying as much of the infrastructure as they can.
Yes, they are. It's very easy to go from environmentalism to business bashing. There's always almost anything you can do involves some amount of pollution. You know what the biggest polluters are is, by the way, the agricultural interests, which for some reason get away scot-free. But anybody who does anything at all is to say, every time you exhale, you have removed oxygen from the atmosphere and are giving back carbon dioxide instead. So the pollution is to some degree inevitable, but we can just make intelligent trade-offs, and I think conservatives have a lot to say about that that could be useful and should be said.
Well, I think where we get into trouble is the other side dominates the media, they talk about acid rain, and of course there's nobody to point out the fact that the acid rain scare is not valid.
Absolutely.
And half a billion dollars was spent by the Congress. I'm sure you know, but many of our listeners don't. $500 million, $500 million spent by an extensive study by the Congress that came up with the conclusion that it was all created by the media. There were a few lakes in the Northeast that were acid, and that was because of ash coming down from the hillside.
And I think for $500,000, you could pour enough lime into them to cure the problem, couldn't you? Something like that?
And that's exactly it. And, you know, and when you talk about the ozone, people say, well, of course there's an ozone hole. I mean, everybody knows there's an ozone hole, and you try to explain it to them,
but it's because of the degree of control over their minds by the radical left, or at least
yes,
by the media.
Yes, and the people, too, we must not forget that there is a free-floating anxiety in the population, which the media love to gnaw on like a loose tooth. If they can't worry about the ozone hole, they'll worry about nuclear winter. If not about nuclear winter, then the greenhouse effect. If not the greenhouse effect, then something else. There's always one dread after another. We went through one horrible week this spring, you remember, in which it looked like a meteorite was going to hit the United States and or the world and smash it, some large meteor in the year 2026 or something like that.
Well, of course, I have always felt that they manipulate our emotions to keep our attention off the really important things. It's the old idea that if you want to rob the bank, why, you certainly burn down the schoolhouse.
Well,
everybody's watching
that's
the schoolhouse.
I'm sure that's true of politicians. I'm not so sure it's true of the media. The media love a serious disaster as well as a manufactured one, maybe better.
Well, you used to be part of the media, so I better be careful what I say.
Well, no, you can say anything you want about the media. I made a cottage industry out of criticizing the media. I've written a book on the subject.
Oh, really? What was that? What's the title?
Called The Coming Battle for the Media. Published in about 1987 by William Morrow and Company, just before computers made it possible for the Media Research Center in Washington to really prove the bias of the media statistically. I think mine was the last of the old books that alleged it and did its best to prove it, but these boys have gone much further than I was able to.
Well, we have a caller here. We have Dudley, who's one of our favorite callers. So, Dudley, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, it's good to hear from you.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it very much, and particularly interested in the fact that the Claremont's going to have a symposium on the welfare state and the underclass. And the question I wanted to ask was, it seems that you, from looking at tax returns and everything, that we're finding out that that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And to substantiate that, they show that 4%, 1959, 4%, the richest 4%, had made as much as the bottom 35%. And in 1989, the richest 4% are making as much as 51%. So it looks like we're getting to a two-class society, and the middle class is getting shrunk. So I'm just curious if you can make some comments.
I'm sorry,
on
I didn't
this.
Mean to interrupt. Were you finished?
Yes, go right ahead.
There's several things to be said here. Perhaps the most important is that you're dealing, remember, with a fluctuating nation. Every year, approximately 1 million illegal immigrants get into this country from Mexico alone. And they immediately flood into that bottom quintile, as it's called. What some people cannot stand is the idea that in the top quintile, somebody, a number of people, got really rich. This gravels people. They cannot stand the idea. And as I said much earlier in this program, if some people don't get rich, I'm not talking about Barbara Streisand. I'm talking about businesses that get created and that do well. If they don't, you are not going to have new employees. There is no way in which our economy can prosper if we don't let people get rich. And so we've got to get over the idea that there's some kind of great lesion in the universe when more people are rich in America. That's not the case. But it isn't true either that the poor are getting poorer. That's a lie, a flat lie. An additional absolutely penniless Mexican immigrants, illegal immigrants into this country a year, despite all of the other problems that the underclass has, still it did better. And I might add again, it was under Reagan that it did better. Under which president was it that the bottom, roughly 10%, were forgiven all taxes, whatever, and taken simply off the tax rolls? It was the Reagan presidency. These are the things that don't get told. Mr. Clinton is so busy whipping up class warfare in this country and trying to make us suggest that we all have a vested interest in making the rich suffer. We don't.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, because if we don't have people who are productive, we don't have jobs for the little guy, and that's really what it's all about. And, you know, but I think, really, what Clinton is going to do, and he seems to have a vendetta against professional people, the physicians, I'll tell you quite frankly, I'm getting out of medicine because
I can see that Clinton is going to destroy the private practice of medicine, and if you keep attacking medicine long enough, pretty soon there's not going to be anybody going into medicine. You're going to get second-class people going into the medical field. You're going to get second-class medicine, and the whole system begins to break down.
And yet, you know, that may not even worry the politicians who are doing it. A member of the assembly told me he was talking to a liberal member of the assembly. This was last year. And a private conversation, which he said, don't you realize that the kinds of regulations you are imposing on business in the state of California are what is driving business out of California over the border into Arizona and Nevada? Don't you understand that it is what we do here in Sacramento that is having this effect? And the liberal giggled and said, what do we care? It's the Republicans who are leaving. And you think that you have worried the politicians greatly when you say that the medical care in this country is going to decline? Of course it's going to decline. What do they care whether it declines?
Well, of course, what happens down the line, though, is when you go to the hospital and you need quality medical care and you can't get it, and it's your son or your daughter or your mother or dad who dies or who certainly suffers because of lack of good medical care, it's only at that point are people going to get concerned.
Yes, and they won't be able to go to Canada, will they, to get good medical care, because the Canadians are all trying to come down here.
In fact, you know, the figure has been put out that in New York, which is probably the best example of a totally liberally controlled state, about 1.5 million people are leaving New York every year, and about 750,000 come in from everywhere in the world, usually from the Caribbean and from Africa. But the whole infrastructure of New York City is beginning to crumble, and this is what the liberals want. They want to drive out all the wealthy people and make this a group where everybody's equal. But pretty soon, who's going to pay the taxes? Who's going to take care of those who need medical care?
The wealthy people mail their taxes in from somewhere else, I guess.
Well, unfortunately, the wealthy people or those who possibly can are just picking up and leaving. And this is what the liberal doesn't understand. We have lost over 850,000 jobs from California in the last couple of years, and it's just going to get worse. And it's because of the environmental controls, it's because of the workman's compensation, it's because of the high taxes, and it's because of the government interference in the free enterprise system, and industry isn't going to put up with it, and we're just going to keep going down and down and down as far as the state is concerned. And California, which a few years ago was the state that everybody looked to as the land of opportunity, soon will become the land that, you know, of welfare recipients and immigrants and this wonderful state they are effectively destroying. But it's happening because the people aren't putting responsible people into Sacramento.
And I must say, too, yes, I think that the voters have, at the last, only themselves to blame here. There may have been something that I didn't understand wrong with the proposition on welfare reform that Pete Wilson put on the last ballot in November, but I was astounded when that was defeated because it seemed to me that that was squarely in line with the wishes of certainly a majority of the people that I understand and thought that I to some degree represented or spoke for, and yet the majority of the voters of California turned against that, just on the basis of apparently the charge that it gave Wilson too much power or something of that. So he was unpopular at the time, unpopular with me too, but that was no reason for voting against that proposition.
I don't like Pete Wilson, but I certainly backed him totally on that. Dudley, did you have another comment?
Well, I was just wondering, in terms of if the tax laws that we have are conducive to the fact that the middle class is going down, the rich are getting richer type thing. Because I was reading this book, America, What Went Wrong, by the two Philadelphia Inquirer reporters, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters.
Pulitzer Prize-winning, and you know what that means.
That means they're liberal.
This is the straight liberal line.
Did you read that book, America, What Went Wrong?
I've seen it, yes.
But it was talking, thesis was that the taxes were one of the main reasons why the middle class is getting smaller and smaller.
Well, the middle class, I don't know, you mentioned before the middle class getting smaller. One reason the middle class is getting smaller is that, of course, it depends on how you define it, but that parts of it are rising into what I guess you would call the upper class. Certainly they are making very substantially better incomes than used to be regarded as middle class incomes. And now I suppose we must hate them because they're getting rich, or at least near enough to rich that we ought to hate them anyway. And I don't think that the middle class, I don't think that there is a large number. There are some, yes, there are some middle class, that are falling just below the middle class line, wherever you put that, and that is largely because our big base of manufacturing jobs, which used to keep Detroit auto workers and so on getting very good pay, is now beginning to phase out. We're seeing serious layoffs in General Motors and so on around the country, and in the manufacturing sector generally. But this is to a certain extent the shift of the whole economy, the whole American economy, from one base to another. Well, and this next one will be more highly technological, and eventually will make the people working in those industries more prosperous still.
Well, now, let me ask you a question. How do you feel about the North American Free Trade Association and the argument that's put forward that we're going to be transferring a lot of our jobs to Mexico? Do you favor or do you oppose
NAFTA? In general, I favor the free trade agreement. I don't think that, any protectionist measure is essentially a conspiracy against the consumer. Now, we are both workers and consumers, and we can be protected as workers and still royally shafted as consumers. That happens, too. But the average person in the United States doesn't understand, I think, that when we protect an American industry, what we are doing is prohibiting people from selling to us more cheaply or better things at the same price.
So you would actually, you're a strong supporter.
I'm in favor of it, yes. And to the extent that jobs are lost, and there will be in certain areas, there will be jobs lost in the beginning. These are jobs that Mexicans are just able at this point to do more effectively than we are, because we are designed now for better jobs than that. They will be basically lower level jobs.
Well, now one of the arguments that's made against this, and how would you counter it, is the fact that look, we're told that the Mexicans are going to be buying all of our products, but where are the Mexicans going to get the money to buy our products? Because this is a very, very poor country, other than the fact that they're going to be getting all the jobs that used to be here in America, and the money that they're going to be buying our products with is going to be the money that our workers used to be making working in the automotive industry and the steel industry and the other heavy industries, which we are now putting south of the border.
Well,
in other words,
question that there will be, as I said, a certain job, particularly low-level manufacturing jobs, that it will be easier to put in Mexico, and that will produce some dislocation here. But you've got to look at the overall picture. And even Mexico, to any extent that it manages to prosper by this, where are they going to get the good things of life? They're only going to be made in the United States. And with a free trade and the right to go in there and compete against their local industry, we should have no trouble at all making money. This is a tremendously complicated matter, and I don't want, by sloganeering, to make it sound simpler than it is. There will be, let me say now for the third time, dislocations in the beginning that will cost some American jobs, but they will produce many more jobs than it costs. And in the long run, we will wind up doing better and more profitably the things that we do best.
All right, Dudley, did you have another comment or a question?
No, I just enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Well, it's always good to have you with us. Thank you so very much for calling.
Okay.
And 464-8295, 464-8295, we're drawing down. We're almost to the end of the program here. But if you have a question or a comment that you'd like to make to Mr. Rusher, why, give us a call. One of the things that is a legacy of the Bush administration was the Americans with Disability Act. And this seems to be a lawyer retirement program. This seems to be the sort of a law that is going to make all sorts of impossible demands on American industry. If somebody's blind, you have to provide somebody to see, read to them. If they're deaf, there has to be somebody to sign for them. It seems that people with disabilities are, going to be able to, if they don't get the job, you're going to have to prove that you didn't discriminate against them. Is this of concern to you at all, or do you think this is a move to help those who are disadvantaged and with disabilities.
Now, I'm sorry to say that I wish all the best in the world for people who are disabled in any way, but I think that, like so many other in these victimized so-called minorities, they are simply being used as by the Democratic Party and by the liberals generally to create a further level of intrusion of government into the lives of all the people of this country. The search for people to help becomes terribly, terribly central, finally, to government, to politicians in a democracy. They simply have to find new victims that they can race forward and promise their assistance to, and then those are linked together in a great coalition of feminists and gays and blacks and American Indians and handicapped and the deaf as a separate category. What do they call them? The deaf is the wrong word. I've forgotten. The auditorially impaired or challenged or something like that are being brought online too as a new minority that is going to be helped by the federal government. And as you say, it becomes just another czar has to be created, another set of triplicate forms has to be filled out, another excuse not to bother to go into business at all will be developed, and then they'll wonder where the jobs are.
Well, I agree with you so much. It seems that they're organizing each minority to demand their rights from the government, having forgotten that the government doesn't give rights. These are inherent to us in Declaration of Independence. Our freedoms come from God. Our rights come from God. They don't come from government. But we seem to have replaced...
You will discover that it isn't essentially rights they want, or more precisely the rights they want turn out to take the form of cash.
And yet government has no money other than that which it takes from us by force to give to other groups to get them to vote for government, and then, of course, the spiral continues. And I think the essence of what you said best this evening was about somehow making the Ninth and Tenth Amendments work again. And if we could only get back to these original concepts that our founding fathers had, we could get back to these sound American principles. Where
This is beyond politicians. Politicians aren't leaders anyway. Politicians are followers, bottom feeders, and scavengers, fundamentally. It takes a strong people, first and foremost. And the American people, who are strong, most of them, know this and are prepared, I think, are preparing to assert themselves in ways they will need some guidance as to the ways in which they can make themselves felt effectively. But essentially at bottom, all these are, I think, moral questions. I think that the so-called cultural war is the basic war. I think that until this country learns again the value of self-discipline and the ability to defer gratification and not to look outside of ourselves for some kind of material salvation, until we can do that, then all the rest of it is just politicians having fun. But I think we will do that. I might add that the Claremont Institute is planning a jamboree of a conference on that subject, too. I promise you. That's some distance off in the future yet.
Well, you know, I'm encouraged to see some of the people who are at Claremont. Bruce Hershenson, I understand, is a fellow.
My colleague is a senior fellow. Yes, sir. I'm proud of that.
And Bill Dannemeyer is down there. And, you know, many of...